I'm happy to have you here.
Thank you.
You're becoming a subunit.
It's glad to. I was trying to think this morning. Is this the fourth show? Fourth time I've been here? Fourth or fifth time?
I think it's the fourth time you've been here.
Okay.
And you always bring great show tunes as well. So we're here to talk about, obviously, the next VOC
upcoming on Friday.
Harmonic extravaganza. This Friday at the Registry Theater,
yes.
Which is my, you know, all-time favorite, one of
yes.
my favorite venues in town, has been for years. And these events that you put on
are
the perfect venue to do this because of the 15 by 15 foot screen.
Yes.
And you always do these lovely early 1900s black and white silent horror features.
Well, not all horror. We did
Charlie Chaplin.
We did the comedies.
We did Keaton and Chaplin.
And
yes, sorry. Horror,
yeah,
comedy, film features. But this time around, you're going back to horror, and it's a 1928.
Well, it's not horror.
It's not horror?
No.
Okay.
Well, it's horror-esque.
Horror-esque?
Let's say it's just, you know, melodrama.
Oh, yes. Okay. It is.
Okay.
It's called The Man Who Laughs.
Man Who Laughs.
Mm-hmm.
Based upon the Victor Hugo short story.
Okay.
L'homme qui rit, I believe is how it's, that was not a good French accent. but yeah, no, a 1928 film,
mm-hmm.
Directed by Paul René,
yeah.
who's a German director.
Yes.
And stars Conrad Veidt, who is one of my favorite actors. Of this era, who was in movies we've done. He was in Cat on Dr. Caligari.
Right.
And he was also in Hands of Warlock.
Right.
And also then successfully made the transition to talkies.
Isn't he kind of a Lon Chaney-esque type of guy?
Not so much.
Okay.
I don't know his career all that well, but I mean, I think this was kind of the one film where he was, you know, kind of in, I don't want to say disguise, but he was kind of relying on the, you know, prosthetics to kind of, you know, convey the character, so.
Right. And there's a famous actress in this film as well.
Mary Philbin?
Yeah.
Mary?
Yeah.
Mary Philbin. I brought notes as well, because I don't, yeah, Mary Philbin, who was in Phantom of the Opera.
Yes.
With Lon Chaney.
Yes.
Who actually, Lon Chaney was supposed to be in this movie.
Yeah, what happened there?
He was under contract with a different studio.
So that kind of stuff has been going back, that goes back years.
Yeah.
I can't do the movie because I'm already signed
yeah,
up to
I'm
another.
Under, I'm under, I mean,
I'm
I mean,
under
this
another?
Was, well, I mean, this was back in the day of, you know, you would sign a contract with the studio and you would be in for 8 or 10 pictures or whatever. And,
yeah, and
if
you walked, you were gone, basically, right?
We saw over Christmas, we rented North by Northwest.
Oh, Alfred Hitchcock.
And I was reading about it, and apparently Cary Grant was kind of the first big name to kind of break the studio contract.
Really?
Cycle. I guess he had signed.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He had signed a contract to kind of get started.
Yeah.
And it ended, and I guess he was kind of told to re-sign or give him the option to re-sign, and he kind of said, "No, I'm going to go picture to picture. I'm going to go as an independent freelancer," and his career obviously did quite well, and I guess that kind of started other actors saying, "Well, I don't want to sign a contract either. I don't want to sign a 15-year contract with MGM."
So he
or
set
something like
that. Set a precedent.
Exactly. He kind of busted the union, you know, in a way. But Mary Philbin, who had been in Phantom of the Opera before this, I guess her career didn't really do all that well, unfortunately. And I reading up on her, I guess she had a lot of, I guess there were some parental issues.
You know,
kind of a weird mother and stepfather, and
kind of pushed her around very,
and,
very early age.
And I think this was kind of pretty much, I guess, one of her last big movies. And after that, she kind of disappeared and kind of faded away and kind of
faded away into the
faded away,
black and white,
her
white screen gone.
She was the special guest of honor when the Phantom of the Opera, opera. Debuted in Los Angeles.
Yeah, because she died in the 1990s, I think.
Yeah, she was the special guest of Andrew Lloyd Webber for the premiere performance. So at least she got a little bit of due.
Yeah,
from
which,
that,
which but, is good, which is great.
Yeah.
So how did you I think I always ask you this question. How did you pick this movie? Why?
How do we pick this movie? I don't know. If you've seen any pictures about the movie, you know that the star of the movie has a rather wide grimace. Smile pasted upon his face, which is integral to the movie.
Yes,
but Bob Kane and I forget the other guy's name. They started the Batman comic strip, and I guess they were looking about for a villain,
yes.
and they said, you know, we need a bit of a catch. He needs to have a thing.
Yes,
and even though Conrad Veidt in this movie plays the hero, they took it and said, well, we're going to use this as the villain. And so the Joker was born. And, you know, varying degrees for stories about his origin. Love the second Batman where, you know, Heath Ledger has like three or four different stories as far as how he got the grin and, you know, why
I
so glum,
like Jack
chum?
Nicholson as a Joker, too. I remember when, you know, when he kind of... If anybody hasn't seen the movie, too bad. When he's lying on the ground and he's, you know, he's all broken up and all you hear is this. The laugh box?
Yeah.
That freaked me out.
Yeah.
That freaked me out.
I have a certain fondness for the Cesar Romero.
Well, he was very good too.
From the TV show,
very campy.
It was very campy. And
Adam
the TV
West,
show. And his. And his laugh was,
yeah.
He kind of did that kind of high pitched, and jumped around in the in his purple suit and stuff like that.
Yeah, but and, you know what? I can see why people don't like clowns because they're always smiling, right? And it's kind of creepy when you think about it. But we should rewind back to why we're talking about the Joker because it has everything to do with the plot of this film.
Well, the movie is the story starts. I mean, it actually is a relatively involved movie. This is not just kind of a really linear, straightforward, you know, good guys, bad guys plot.
No, it's fairly
involved. It starts off in the era of King James II, so that's kind of late 1700s. 1690.
Yes.
And he's you know, the only really historical figure in this, but a traitor, someone who's committed treason, is found and brought before him and is killed. And before the count's death, he asks after his son, and the king says, oh, yeah, you know, we found the son. Oh, yeah, and by the way, we sold him to these child-stealing gypsy doctors, Compraccio. Is the name given by Victor Hugo, which is a bit of a made up term, but these are people from folklore who would steal children and then basically turn them into human bonsais, and would stunt their growth or maim them, all for the purpose of selling them to freak shows, or to the noble houses of the time, because everybody needed a court jester.
Yes. Yeah.
A jester. And so anyway, so the kid is sold, and the father, you know, cries in anguish. Then the movie cuts ahead a couple years, and the king has now ordered all the Compraccios to leave England. And so they do, and they leave the son behind because he's a witness. He's evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So he's wandering around. It's this really weird Antarctic like scene of snow and ice and though allegedly happening like in Cornwall or something like that. Anyways, he finds a baby in the snow, and he's wandering around and he comes upon the caravan of a, he calls himself a philosopher. He's really more like a charlatan kind of mountebank. Kind of character named Ursus, and anyways, as it's revealed there, the child by the name of Gwynplaine has a smile permanently etched into his face.
Yeah,
and that's where kind of the first that scene ends. You then cut ahead about 20 years, I guess, maybe a little bit longer. And now Ursus and Gwynplaine and the girl, whose name is Dee, excuse me, they are now a traveling show. And Gwynplaine is a clown.
Which makes sense.
Which makes sense. Actually, historically not accurate. The first painted face clown appeared like 50, 70 years later. Anyways, they go to the countryside. They do a play called L'Homme qui Rit. Gwynplaine is eventually identified. One of the gypsy doctors has snuck back into England, realizes this could be used as leverage, blackmail against the king. Actually, now it's Queen Anne. And the jester from King James is now in the court of Queen Anne. And the Gwynplaine's father's estate has passed on to the Countess Duchess Josiana, who looks a lot like Madonna, a Russian woman who did not make the transition to talkies because of her thick Russian accent, from what I read. Anyways, the Gwynplaine's estate has now passed to her. The jester doesn't like her, isn't particularly fond of her. He's trying to ingratiate himself to the queen, who doesn't like her either, and says, oh, by the way, the rightful heir to the estate has resurfaced. And for the Duchess to maintain the estate, she has to marry. She should have to marry him. But he doesn't love the Duchess. He loves Dee.
That's right.
Who's blind?
Yeah,
blind. And you know, is a very poignant love story because he's too embarrassed by his smile that he doesn't feel that he can actually deserve any love.
Beauty and the Beast.
And then it all comes to the kind of swashbuckling conclusion. With them sword fighting around the town. Gwynplaine has refused the estate. He renounces it, renounces the lordship that he was to be given because of it, embarrasses the queen in the process, and is trying to run away to join Ursus and Dee, who have been told to leave the country. And so then we've got, you know, the jester trying to keep Gwynplaine here and all that. And it does have a happy ending.
Don't tell us.
Unlike Hugo's original story, in which basically everybody dies.
Well, that's Victor Hugo for you.
But this movie, does have a happy ending. And yeah, and it's this weird balance because the German director, German star, taking place in you know early 1700s England, but yet it still has this very German expressionistic feel to it, you know the sets and
yes.
you know the shadows and the lighting and all that. Certainly they weren't trying to make a, I don't want to say a period piece, but you know, they kind of really weren't trying to hide, or the director Paul Lenny wasn't, you know, was just doing what he felt natural doing, which was the very German expressionistic
film style
know, approach.
Yeah.
So anyways, so yeah, so I mean that's a lot of a movie, and
it is, so
but it is good. I mean you've got the love story, you've got little treason and hate and revenge. At the end you've got this kind of sword fight. There's a dog in it as well. Ursus has a pet dog. This is where it gets a little perhaps politically incorrect by these days, but
well, it was the, you know,
but Ursus 1700s. Ursus, being a philosopher, gave his dog an ironic name, which he gave him the Latin word for man. Is what he called him, which is homo.
Homo, yeah.
And so there's a couple scenes where Ursus, you know, calls to the dog, you know, and tells homo to be quiet and all that. So we know there'll be a couple snickers out of the audience for that. But,
oh, for sure. So how does the music? How did you find the music to accompany?
Well,
the film, like,
we're doing two different. This movie actually had a hit single written for a song called Love Comes Stealing, mm-hmm. Which I have. I brought a version of, sung by Frank Munn, who we all know was the star, made a star by the National Palmolive Radio Show from 1917 to 1921. Anyways, and then the other music that we're doing is that, thanks to the wonders of this thing called the internet, I found a compilation of dance music from the time, from the late 1600s or early 1700s, and it's all very, you know, you can almost see, you know the Morris dancers out there doing this kind of very, you know, square dance-ish kind of moves and all that. We of course don't do it straight up. We're not here to recreate, but I kind of went through and said, okay, you know, this song is for this scene and this song's for that scene. And then,
so you might just to interject, well, here, do you have any like sort of carnival music, like Painted Caravan?
No, I mean
freak show,
you know we do try to kind of let the music let the film set the tone. And you know, I mean the music is certainly kind of bouncy and kind of jaunty, you know, all on its own. You know, we don't for those of you that have been to our show, you know that we don't do things straight up, and there's
no, and people often love your, people love your shows. They'll come to the video store and rave at me,
really,
about them after.
Oh, that's great.
Yes,
that's
yes.
great. But no, we don't do things straight up. We always kind of, well, we rehearse so that people kind of know the tune and know who's playing and all that, and then we just say, you know what, just do whatever you want, and you know, everybody is comfortable enough with each other that, you know, I think we can, you know, bake a pretty good cake.
Yeah, you do. You know, so. Just for people who don't know, who are the members of VOC? Philharmonic?
Bradford Nowak, yep. Is on drums. I don't know if he's bringing his trumpet for this one. I think he is. Bradford is now also a new member of My Sweet Patootie, the Owen Sound-based folk trio now.
Oh.
We have David Hunsberger, mm-hmm. Local famous local artist on clarinet. A regular, I think it's a B-flat, and bass clarinet. We have Steve Lederman out of Toronto, who spent his time in 80s hair metal bands back in his youth, but now...
What? I'm just curious.
What was the name of the band? What was the name of the band? I'm sorry. You can Google
Room
them.
Room of Fools? Or?
You can Google... No, okay. It's Reckless or something like that.
Reckless?
It might have been. Anyway, so Steve plays a lot of drums and percussion. I think what he'll be doing mostly for this one though is gongs.
Gongs, that'd be beautiful in that space.
He's also becoming more and more proficient with low brass. Mm. At the Chaplin, he had a euphonium.
Okay.
Which is tuba-like.
Tuba-like instrument.
And he
That's
also
right.
has, I think it's a bass trombone. I think he also played. We have Wade Whitaker on guitar, acoustic, electric, and then there's myself on, for this gig, it's double bass. But Wade and I do kind of like our effect pedals. So at times you'll be hearing sounds that you didn't think could come out of
a bass.
Our instruments, but we have all kinds of wizardry and gadgetry available for our sonic pleasure, and hopefully yours as well.
I have a question here.
Okay.
You know, for the other shows that you've done,
yeah.
Do you guys have any recordings of these?
We do record ourselves.
Okay.
Mostly for our own edification. I have gone back and listened to some of our stuff, and I guess ultimately perhaps for the better, just on its own, it at times doesn't really work.
Okay.
You're kind of listening to it and you're thinking, oh, okay, well, that's kind of interesting. And then it kind of will kind of maybe hover around. It doesn't move as much.
No, I guess it
as
is.
because we're there.
You're following a film.
We're following
so
the film.
More filmic
yeah.
in nature.
Yeah. So you know, if there's a fairly, you know, dramatic scene, we'll kind of maybe, you know, hover on a feeling and not move from that too much, because we don't want to distract.
Yeah,
from the movie.
Yeah.
I mean, these are all great movies.
You're another dimension.
Well,
they don't sonic dimension.
They don't need our help.
Yeah.
You know, so we're there to kind of help support. A few people have come up afterwards, and I've taken this as a huge compliment. They said, there are times when I even forgot you guys were playing the music.
Oh, that's great.
Which I think great. I mean, I'm glad that we've kind of worked ourselves into the music, that we're not obvious. It's not, oh, hey, look at the five guys on stage making noise that has nothing to do with what's going on the screen. So I'm glad that we can kind of work our way in. I mean, we're not doing, big... John Williams overtures
This is like an accentuation.
I always tell the guys, I tell everybody, it's always better to kind of underscore, to kind of, you can get a lot more mileage out of underplaying than overplaying. And there are times where if you can kind of find the right notes or the right chord or the right kind of riff, that, for lack of a better term, you just milk it for all it's worth. You don't need to think people are getting bored, because we're there to support.
Yeah, exactly. And why don't we take a musical break?
Okay.
And play this.
You've got Love Comes Stealing. I think this is I pulled this off archive.org, so yep. it is from a 78. So
isn't
it's not
amazing.
It's certainly better quality than some of the other 78 recordings they have, but it does have a bit of a warble.
I have a question. Do we call you the artistic director of VOC Southern Harmonic? Do you have a moniker?
No.
All right.
No. I'm just kind of, the guy.
The guy. Well, this is Coral FM, and I'm here with the guy from VOC Silent Film Harmonic. And this is Love Comes Stealing from 19...
When was this? 1928. This is Frank Munn singing with the, I believe it's the Regent Club Orchestra.
Okay.
Backing him up.
Thank you.